Good afternoon. I'm Tyler Friel, and you are listening to WISR 680 AM and 107.5 FM. It is the extended news at noon, and today we are sitting down with Congressman Mike Kelly. He is the representative of the 16th District, which includes Butler County and other parts of the Northwest here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. It's great to have you in studio, Congressman. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Tyler. This is We got a pretty nice day today, and they tell me the weekend is even going to be better. They say maybe you get up even into the 80s, so it's spring in Butler.
Exactly. We had a little bit of everything. It's a Western PA spring week, so it's kind of nice to be back here. And at least nice to look forward to 80
degrees.
Yes,
absolutely.
I have no doubt about it.
I'm with you.
Well, anyways, like I said, great to have you here. With a number of topics that we want to hit on, there's a lot happening in the world and here at home. But first, I want to start with basically the 16th District. You are running for re-election, and the 16th District looks similar, a little bit different, and includes all of Butler County now. So, you know, you're seeking another term. Essentially, you know, why are you running for office again, and what are your goals and ambitions for the people in the 16th District?
Yeah, great question. And I think people ask, so why are you running again? And the answer is, whenever you first get elected, you're at the very bottom of the list of representatives, and you have to work your way to the top. You earn your way in different committees, and I think that the general public does not understand that once a congressman gets elected, your real objective is to get on committees that actually have an effect on the people that you represent. And I'm not putting down any of their committees, but right now I'm on Ways and Means. Now, with Ways and Means, people ask all the time, well, what is it? I said, well, that's everything in your life that is critical. They said, really? I said, yeah, it's tax policy, it's health policy, it's trade policy, and all the things that you would look at and think, wow. And keep in mind, I use the word policy because policy is the key to everything that happens in our government. And people sometimes pay attention to it, sometimes they don't. But the policy that's in place, and we're always looking for some policy that is pro-growth policy, not something that hinders people from being successful, but actually makes it easier for them to get there. So whether you do it through tax policy, whether you look at trade and what's happening in trade and say, oh my goodness, we've lost a lot of our basic trade, a lot of our basic products because of our global trade policies that sometimes hurt America. And so you look at things like that, look at healthcare, which is a huge issue. Probably the biggest issue at any time in any election is healthcare. What's happening with healthcare? Listen, the world I grew up in, people didn't have the ability to have knees replaced, hips replaced, have hearts replaced. So you look at all the things that we have today, it's a lot different than it used to be. And it also cost a lot more. And so they're trying to figure out what can we do to make healthcare more universal and more affordable. Now, how do you do that? In some cases, you have to subsidize folks that are in a position that they can't afford to do some of these things. So it's taken me a while to work my way up in seniority with Ways and Means. I will be, after this election, if the voters send me back to Washington, I will be third in line when it comes to the chairmanship of Ways and Means, but also I'm sitting right now on the subcommittee for taxes. It's tax revenue. I call it tax revenue, and that's really key to us. So what's the goal? The goal has always been, since I got there, let's make sure that we spend our days doing the right thing for the right reasons, and good things will happen. And so that's been the whole thing. It's one of those things that people, because of the polarization, I think, between Republicans and Democrats and independents, a lot of people have just kind of washed their hands and say, you know what, I can't stand the fighting. I can't stand the fact that they can't get anything done. I'm not going to vote anymore. And I tell people all the time, please, please, the goal, because this is happening in our country right now, the goal is to make sure that people disconnect and say, I'm not voting because I don't care about it. And the thing I tell everybody that I talk to, understand that every single person sitting in any office doesn't just walk in and sit down. They get elected. And sometimes they get elected because there's nobody running against them. Other times they get elected because people wake up and they say, oh my God, this is horrible. I got to find somebody who's going to go and represent me. Most important election, as far as I'm concerned, is people that sit in public school boards. And I think the pandemic has made us all aware of what happens in our classrooms. Pandemic put the classroom in the home. The student was there with the parent, and people started to look at things and say, oh, wait, whoa, 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 whoa. this is not what I thought was going on. So I always encourage people, please go to your school board meetings. Please pay attention to what's happening. Take a look at curriculum, take a look at textbooks, and take a look at the direction that your city, your town is going in, and make sure that whoever it is that you trust to educate your children is doing things that you know are the right things to do. So these elected offices, I guess we can go into a general conversation about that, but it is critical. Who people vote into office is absolutely critical. And policy, I ask people all the time, please look at the policy. Forget the politics. Forget whether you wear a red shirt, a blue shirt, whether you could care less, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, a Libertarian, or somebody who just gets up in the morning and says, you know what, I'm glad to be an American. It's critical that we pay attention to who we put in place that develops our policy. That is the whole key.
Well, I'm curious because, you know, you mentioned being there, being a part of the game helps you bring, you know, helps you understand what's going on in Washington. So when you hear a pitch from somebody, they're running as an outsider, they're running, I'm going to bring change to Washington. Yeah. What do you think makes a good congressman, congresswoman? Because it does seem like there needs to be insider knowledge of how Washington works in order to get something accomplished.
I think the key to any of this is that you look at who it is that's going to represent you, represent your district, these people, there's 435 districts, mm-hmm. right? Some of them are very similar. None of them are exactly the same. You should be looking for somebody that actually has been in the private sector at some point in their life. Now, my friends who have been professional politicians don't like me talking like this because I get along with them, but I always say to them, have you ever been in a situation where you had to have payroll and you had to make payroll and everybody gets paid but you because it was a rough month for your business? And until you go through that fire, until you go through that, I think it's really difficult. And people make decisions on policy that they have no idea of what the heck it is that they just put into place. So why I tell people all the time, please look at who it is that's running for these offices and look at, do they represent the values and the principles that you hold dear and the area that you come from? It changes. It changes. I really am so thankful that the district that I'm in has a wide range of everything. Agriculture, huge. Manufacturing, huge. More than anything else, Pennsylvania's 16th Congressional District is a huge district that embraces all of those. Erie in the north, which is a big city, which is down, it's about a third of the size it used to be, lost a lot of jobs there, all the way down to where we are, and then over as we drift into Newcastle. But this is all blue-collar people, that for the most part. And I think that the energy situation we have great opportunities with Marcellus. We have opportunities that other districts don't have. But I think look at who it is that represents you, your principles. And the other thing I tell people, please, don't be a one-issue person. We're really big. I think my number one concern is always pro-life and making sure that we're doing the right things because I just can't understand why we can't do some of these things and why we can't protect the unborn. And when you look at the numbers of people, we've talked about the pandemic, and we're so concerned about that. There are far more abortions, and we lose little boys and little girls in abortion than we lose through the pandemic. So people need to put their hat on and take a look at it. So getting back to the basics of it, look at who it is that's running. Look at his or her background. Look at what their basic beliefs are, how they express them, and is that the person you want going to represent you? And I tell people all the time, I'd rather be called Representative Mike Kelly than Congressman Mike Kelly, because I represent 705,687 people in Pennsylvania's 16th Congressional District. You got to know the whole district, you got to know the people, and you got to know the issues that are most dear to them and near to them. So it's not a hard thing to figure out. But it takes an awful lot of energy. It takes more than anything else, the desire and the goal to do things that are productive, things that are pro-growth, things that really touch on what it is that we are, the very basics, the very core values that the district has. So, and the other thing I always tell people, the infection of going to Washington, D.C., I tell people all the time, I didn't go to Washington to bring Washington's ideas back to Pennsylvania's 16th Congressional District. I went from Pennsylvania's 16th Congressional District to Washington to bring the values that are the most important to the people that I represent. And I think that's the goal. If you can stay centered, on who it is that you represent. Take yourself out of it. Forget about the ambition. Forget about all this idea that why I'm going to be this or I'm going to be that. Just be the best representative representing the people that you that send you. And I think that's the key to it. And I think you can get, listen, people get starstruck. They think, oh my God, I'm a congressman now, and people come to me and they ask, oh, congressman this, congressman that. And so, you know, please get away from that idea, because it's not about you. It's about the people you represent.
We just went through redistricting here in Pennsylvania because in the latest census, we were down in population, or lagging population growth, if you will. And I mean, you would know best. I think, you know, when you graduated Butler, do you remember how many people were in your graduating class?
Yeah, there were almost, I think it's just over 1,000.
Yeah, and when I came through in 2012, that number was around 550. And there's some classes now at Butler that are under 400. So we have seen locally population decline. Everywhere you drive, you see now hiring signs, so it doesn't feel like the workforce is as robust as it needs to be. What policies do you think are out there that would help spur population growth in this area in Western Pennsylvania?
Well, I think the biggest hindrance to people bolstering the economy is, where is it that you can go and know that you can be successful, that you're not going to be hindered in some way by policies that are put in place that make it difficult for you to get to that end. Now, people say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, here's what I mean by that. You look right now. I think it would be hard for anybody to look at the wonderful opportunity we have with the Marcellus Shale, with gas. And you look at that and you think about, this is an energy source that is incredible. We've been called the Saudi Arabia of gas, the Pennsylvania has. And what you have to be careful of is, let's not put policies in place that make it more expensive to take the product out of the ground than what you can sell it for or what it's worth once it's out. And so you say, okay, how do you do that and do it safely? Yes, you got to do it safely. You got to make sure that you're protecting the environment, but we have the ability to do that. When you do things like that, when you encourage that type of development, that also brings jobs to the area. And I think the key to almost everything we do is, let's make sure that we don't affect the economy in a way that's negative, that we put things in place that actually build the community, build the state, build the country. One of the things I think really bothers me more than anything else is where we are with energy right now. And I just filled up my car before I came to see you. It used to cost me about $65 to do it. It was over $100 today. And we look at some of the policy that's put in place, and you have to make a decision whether you fill your car or feed your kids, because the price of everything has just skyrocketed. Again, policies. Policies, policies, policies. What is it that caused that? What is it that's making it harder for people to be successful? So I think what we do, first of all, in the district that we're in, the energy policies are the things that are really key, because we are blessed with things that God has put there. We didn't put it there. God put it there. It's our job to get it out of there and get it out of there safely.
And I remember the first boom of Marcellus shale drilling. It was huge 15 years ago. I don't want to say it petered out, but it does not feel as robust as it once was. Why is that, and what do you think could spur innovation in that field once again here in this area?
Yeah. Well, I think almost everything else, the basic economics is supply and demand. Mm-hmm. So if you have a greater supply than the demand, the value of whatever it is that you have for sale goes down. I know, you know, I'm in the automobile business. So when we talk about supply, we have no supply there because of the our inability to produce some of our own semiconductor chips and do all the things we need to do. We have limited production right now. So the prices go up. Basic economics on it, really, I think that because of the amount of natural gas that we have, it's driven down to a large part the value or the cost of it. So bringing it out of the ground sometimes is more expensive than what you can market it for. With gasoline, though, different situation, right? Mm-hmm. So we go through a situation where people look at the future and say, or do we have a limited supply? And the demand then starts to turn around, and we start paying a lot more than we did before. And people say, well, how do you temper that? And the president's talked about going to our strategic oil supply. And I tell people all the time, you don't want to do that. That strategic oil supply is there for a reason. It's there for when we don't have the ability to get get energy or get the oil out of the ground or get whatever it is that we need to get, don't interfere with that. That's strategic. That's your savings account. That's something you don't touch until you need it, that rainy day. So a lot of what we look at today is supply and demand. It's basic economics. And the other thing is the spending that we're doing. And I will just say this from the beginning. I think sometimes we get confused. And right now, we like to talk about kitchen table economics. So the basics of revenue that we're going to, the government, this is the federal government, not the state government or your local government, because everybody has a hand in taxing you. But the federal government, we're looking at the greatest revenues we've ever had. It's about $4.6 trillion a year. I mean, that's an incredible amount of money. But we're spending $6.4 or $6.5 trillion. That's what we're spending. And people say, well, that sounds like a lot, but it's only only $2 trillion difference, right? And I said, well, here's what it is. You make $46,000 a year, $46,500, and you go out and spend $67,000. And people look at you and say, well, no, you can't do that. I said, we're doing that. We're doing it this year. We did it last year. We've done it every year. We are reaching right now a point where it is unthinkable of what our debt is. Now, people say, yeah, what is our debt? And we're saying, well, we think it's about $30 trillion, which is unimaginable to anybody. The real debt we have between funded and unfunded liabilities going forward is over $150 trillion right now. Now, here's the whole point. If we can't realize that we're spending ourselves into a situation where we will be depending on other people helping us pay our bills, and if your paycheck that you get every month, that if 75 or 80% of it is based on just paying the interest on what it is that you've borrowed or spent, that doesn't end well. So, Tyler, I think the biggest thing we face right now is we're not facing the reality of where we are. Now, I don't want to be a gloom and doom guy, because that's not the way to go. And the other answer is people always say, well, you can't fix something with nothing. The something that we need to put into place is policy that understands going forward. We've got to pay down that debt. And people tell me, are you worried about your kids and your grandkids? I said, yes, I am worried about that. They're going to inherit that. But I also worry about the current situation, the people on the ground right now. It's going to affect all of us. So we face so many challenges. But we're in America. We have more resources. We have more gifts from God. We have so many things that are in place. My gosh, we're talking about Ukraine being the breadbasket. What about America? What about us? What about what we're able to do agriculturally? What about what we're able to do with energy? We were the biggest exporter of energy in the world until we shut down all our domestic supplies. That makes no sense to anybody. So I tell people, if you can just take back off, get a little bit further away from what it is you're reading and get it into focus, is what is the long range situation, short term, and right now, today, what is it that we can do?
And it feels, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like if, you know, spending is up and also, you know, the debt is up, it feels like there would have to be cuts somewhere or taxes would need to be raised. So it feels like those are the two options. And obviously, program cuts are difficult. If you give somebody something, they don't really want it taken away. So how does Washington navigate that territory of maybe putting cuts on the line or, you know, increasing taxes?
No, I know. Listen, it's a really good point. So I'm a grandfather of 10, father of 4. And I would say to all those folks out there that are in that same situation, which is a wonderful thing, get married, have kids, kids grow up, and they have kids, and all of a sudden you have this family. I can remember when I first started off giving my kids an allowance with the caveat that, you know, I may not be able to do this every month, but here's where we are right now. Now, everything's fine until you can't give them that little bit of money to work with. And all of a sudden it's like, well, wait a minute. You got to do that for me. That's what I spend. You say, yeah, but I'm not in a position to do it right now. So we're, you know, that sounds simple, but that's really the way people are. We love it when things are going the right way. When we have to cut back, sometimes we're cutting people back on things that they became used to that they weren't used to before. And all of a sudden it's like, well, I can't do that. I can't make that cut. If you're running for office, and you tell somebody you're going to cut back on some programs, well, for some people say, well, I can't vote for a person that's going to do that. So politicians are always on that tight wire. They're sitting there and they're really that high wire and thinking, you know what, if I do this, is it going to cause that? So it's a cause and effect thing. I think that for most of us, we understand basic economics. You can't spend more than you make. You can't borrow yourself into oblivion, and you can't be looking at long-range responsibilities that make it impossible for you to put your head in a pillow at night and actually go to sleep. So I think it's going to take an awful lot. And number one, we spend a lot of money, and here's the problem. 70% of our budget, federal budget, we have to spend it. It's a mandate. We have to spend it. So we can't really play with it. It's there, and we can't do anything about it. That other 30% we can work with, but it's always like, so where do you make the cuts and still be able to provide what people expect?
And selfishly, you know, I it's the ongoing joke of, I don't know, of everybody makes it in my generation, but, you know, are we going to get Social Security? You know, I mean, down the line, is that, do you think that's something that the Congress can guarantee that, you know, 40 years, hopefully, when I retire, that there would be Social Security on the line? I mean, those are real breadbasket issues way down the line, but something that could be coming down the pipeline.
I think that what would really help, again, on what it is that you know to be true. So people ask me about their Social Security. I said, well, you know where the money for Social Security comes from? And they said, yeah, the government. I said, no, check your paycheck. You pay 6.2%. It's a match by whoever it is that you work for. It's 12.4% out of every paycheck. Just think if you could do that personally and have a bank account going like that. That's what Social Security depends on. It depends on the workforce, the people who are working. Now, and the answer to some of it, I have colleagues on the other side of the aisle, said, well, we have to raise the amount of money that we tax people on their paycheck. And I said, well, but when you do that, you make it hard for them to exist in real life. Social Security is in danger. There's no question about that. We don't see the revenues that are going to be able to support the number of people that are retired, because you have to reach a certain age to get to Social Security or some type of an injury or sickness, right? I think the key to that, again, if you want more money in Social Security, then make sure you're filling those revenue streams. More working people supplying more revenue to Social Security would be great. I do believe in some cases, and I have friends that have told me this, maybe people that have retired and have a higher income, maybe that's not as key to them as it is to other folks that never had the high income. But the sustainability of any program is the key. And I think we need to take a look at, a real hard look and an honest look at, what is it that we can do? We can cut benefits for the very highest earners and raise then for the people that are at the lower end of it that helps them to get through life. Because as you know, with the situation right now, when inflation starts to come about, when you have inflation at 8.5% and rising, so everything that you put on your table, everything you put in your mouth, everything else has become so expensive, that's Social Security for people in a certain age group and a certain financial situation. That is absolutely critical. So I've always thought is, how do you protect the most vulnerable? And if we can do that, it requires people saying, you know what, I'm going to be okay with that. I'm going to be okay. And I do believe that I don't think we need to have the cap on what people make, and people, high earners, say, okay, once you reach, you don't have to pay any more on it. I don't see why we do that. I think we need to take a really good look at that and say, let's continue to have that wage tax in there. And again, going back to the understanding that folks have to have is, this is really every single penny from Social Security comes from the workforce and the people they work for. It does not come from the government. There's so much confusion about what the government does. The government does nothing when it comes to revenue other than collect it and then distribute it. But the government does not produce revenue. It extracts revenue.
We're talking with Congressman Mike Kelly. One of the issues on Ways and Means that you have been advocating for is grain-oriented electrical steel. There are some tariffs that are put in place, or loopholes that people are able to go around. Obviously, now Cleveland-Cliffs is one of the largest producers in America of grain-oriented electrical steel. Now, this has gone through two administrations, the Trump administration and the Biden administration. I know you and your colleagues have been advocating for essentially this loophole to close. Any reason as to why you don't think that has happened yet?
The lack of attention. what I understand, and so I don't care whether it's a Trump administration or the Biden administration, my job, my goal has been to make sure that it rises up on their list of what are critical things. And what I think, Tyler, when you look at this, we're the last domestic producer of grain-oriented electric steel. And people say, so well, I don't know what you're talking about, Kelly. I said, well, when you're driving, look at telephone poles. And every time you see that gray canister, understand that inside that canister is steel that makes it possible for the flow of electricity. Electricity is like water. It has to flow. So we have these containers there that actually push it. When we, in Butler, Pennsylvania, with 1,400 people, men and women, that go down and produce it, when we're the last producer domestically of that, if we didn't learn anything from this pandemic, please don't tell me that South Korea, that the Russians, that anybody else in the world is going to produce this product, and we're going to be able to have the ability to get it. Right now, the language that's the problem is that we made the exclusion. We don't want to shut people off completely that we deal with around the world, but we need to shut down smaller, make it smaller, what it is that they're allowed to bring into our country. Most of the people that we compete against are owned by a government. They're not owned privately. This steel mill that started off as Columbia, then it became Armco, then it became AK, now it's Cleveland-Cliffs. Every American should know that supply for that grain-oriented electric steel, which is critical to the flow of electricity. And if we're going to do infrastructure, that is something that bothers me because we're not looking at real infrastructure. I want that to be the number one thing. I've talked to so many people. I talked to Ambassador Lighthizer. I talked to Ambassador Tai. I've talked to Ross, who was the Commerce Secretary, trying to get now to other people in the Biden administration to tell them, please, look, it's not about me. It's not about Republicans. It's not about Democrats. It's about the ability for America to produce exactly what it needs and not to rely on some foreign source that at some point could say, you know what, we're not going to send it to you. Now, we have been lax in our ability to look at this and call it out for what it is. And when we see people getting away with this, we need to shut them down. We need to say, you know what, you're not doing it according to what the agreement was. We're going to look at the exclusion again and say we're not going to allow you to take over a market that we have here in the United States. And people tell me all the time, well, you're an insider on that. I said, you're God dang right I am. That's a half a mile from the dealership that my family owns. It's a mile from my home. I pass it many times during the day. I've been inside it many times, so I am an insider. I know the guys that make it. I know the girls that make it. I know the critical crisis we have right now with our inability to shut down foreign sources coming in and ruining the market. So that's a fight that we fight every day. And I think what we're always trying to do, we're trying to get attention. And I have a lot of colleagues now that come up and they ask me, so what is this you're taught? What is this GOES? And I said, well, it's grain-oriented electric steel. That's what's in the transformers. That's what propels this electric current through our lines. And they'll say, oh, okay, well, you really believe this. I say, yeah, I don't even believe it. I'll take you anytime you want down to this mill and you can see it. We need to protect our own assets and quit worrying about our friends. Now, I get upset with this when it comes to the Koreans, because if it isn't for America, there is no South Korea. They know it. We know it. The stuff that's happening right now, the steel that's sent into Mexico, cut there, and then shipped over to America. And then we said, well, we build the transformer here in America. I said, yeah, I know, but take the cover off it and look inside. If it doesn't say Cleveland Cliffs, I don't want it. I don't want it on any pole. I don't want it pushing any current. I tell people, listen, Am I so fixed on that I would say I don't want any foreign steel? Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're the last producer. When we go down, if we're not able to sustain and we lose that ability to produce that steel, who is it that we're going to rely on? And how reliable are they? Because friends are friends until you need them. And all of a sudden, then they become people who are interested in you but don't really watch you. This country needs to be so protective of our assets.
Last one for you.
Sure.
For the past 6-7 months or so, Butler County Commissioner meetings have been dominated by talk of election fraud. There's a group of voters that come to these meetings every other week, and they are basically their belief is that the election was fraudulent. Things happened behind the scenes in which the real count was not the actual count. And the kind of on a broader scale, there has been a recent resignation of an election director here in the county. So there has been a lot of turnover in that position. These are hot button issues right now. And, you know, my question to you is basically, how do you navigate? Because you filed a lawsuit for mail-in ballots, believing that they were unconstitutional, lawsuit that was found to be correct. How does the state navigate election integrity? How do people know that these results can be true? And essentially, why can, do you believe that the 2020 election results were true? Do you believe that, you know, this primary is going to be held correctly? Essentially, your thoughts overall on election integrity.
Well, this election, more than any past election, was held in a way that we had never seen before. We have had, since I think like 1812, maybe the Civil War, absentee ballots. So it wasn't a matter of that wasn't available to people that could not be in their home district when voting took place. So that was already in place. All of a sudden, this no-excuse mail-in ballot came up, and people started saying, wait a minute, how does that work? And here's exactly how it works. It works any way people want it to work. The drop boxes, now keep in mind, think about that. We said, well, you know, if you can't get to a polling place, we'll have drop boxes where you can just drop your ballot off. So I said, well, who has oversight there? Who's watching that? I know at the polls that we have people that are there. You know, everybody's going to be okay with that. And it's, these little things that took place turned into big things. When we saw the turnout this year, nobody expected. We saw it in the primaries, Ty. That's when people first started. No, that's when we noticed it. That's when we called attention to the fact that, hey, this new process has really opened a Pandora's box that you may never be able to close again. The idea is one person, one vote. When all of a sudden there's drop boxes where people can put in whatever they want, whenever the election day doesn't end on election day, but goes for 3 days later while we count votes that were the no-excuse mail-in ballots, and we start looking at that, here's the greatest loss was not the loss of the presidency. That was not the greatest loss. The greatest loss was the faith, the trust, and the confidence that the American people have in the way we vote. I've always thought it was pretty standard. You know, if I wasn't going to be in town because a job kept me out of town, I'd do the absentee ballot. I saw the numbers. The numbers, while not impossible or implausible, you look at it and say, are you telling me that this many votes came in this year? This has never happened before. Are you telling me that we looked at ballots that had one choice and one choice only, and that was the top of the ticket? And no other votes on the left side of the ballot or the right side? I mean, even the day I voted and my wife was right beside me, she said, hey, you're not on the ballot. I said, no. It goes Biden-Harris, it goes Trump-Pence, and then it goes all these state offices and everything. The congressional office was on the far right side, the very last choice. And I don't know why didn't they do it the other way? Why didn't they put all the federal offices and the state office, however they wanted to do it, but put them together? Here's the thing. Our objection to the election was about the fact that Pennsylvania, the state, can amend its voting process. But there's a whole process of what you have to do, and I won't go through it right now. That was not done. So our objection to it, the fact that it was not the change in the voting process was not done constitutionally. When the Supreme Court, it goes to the Supreme Court, and we needed four justices to say, okay, we'll look at the case, right? That's all we were asking. Just look at it so we can be assured that something didn't happen that we thought happened. So when you have Justice Alito, when you have Justice Gorsuch, when you have, it comes down to Justice Thomas, and Coney Barrett didn't want to look at, didn't even show up. They should we look at it? I have no opinion on it. Kavanaugh, I have no opinion on it. The rest of the court, all we needed was four justices to look at it. Justice Thomas said, I am baffled by what this court thinks it should be looking at. To me, to me, and this is something that I don't want to argue with anybody about it, but it is a matter of faith and trust and confidence. The Supreme Court failing even to look at it, people start to think, oh my gosh, even the court, the highest court in the land, decided I don't even want to look at it. And at that point, then people start to disconnect and say, so what is our justice system about? Do we really have a review? Do we really look at things that are important? Do we really make a judgment on things? And when they failed to even look at it, I think that just added, again, to the belief in a lot of people's hearts and minds that this voting process that we go through isn't right. It isn't fair. It isn't protected. It isn't something we trust anymore. And when that happens, so no constitution, no law, no court can restore in people's hearts their belief that we're in America and we're doing things according to the right process and the right law. When that happens, if it's in a friendship, it's in a relationship, and you know this, everybody knows it out there, when you lose that faith and trust and confidence, it destroys the relationship. And when the relationship's destroyed, that makes it impossible to go forward with people to say, you know what, I love what this country stands for, and I love being here, and there's a process that protects us. That did not happen with the review with the Supreme Court. That was the last case that could have done it. And also, we go forward. There's another case out there, but again, I just say that there's things that have to be looked at and things that have to be determined. The numbers just don't make sense. They just don't make sense. And I think the fact that we drew out the election 3 days beyond when it should have stopped, and it creates that doubt. And that's a huge thing right now that we face.
So who corrects that doubt? I mean, is it the problem? And the arguments you hear from these people at the county commissioner meetings are not necessarily to the unconstitutionality of mail-in ballots, but they're rather arguing that there's rigged modems inside these machines. You've got multiple theories as to why people don't believe these elections results. It's one thing to say mail-in ballots are unconstitutional. Right. It's another thing to say that the Chinese are stealing votes out of the electoral machine.
Yeah.
So that's how wide-based. And it feels like, you know, are politicians responsible for restoring that faith in the elections by telling the voters, hey, this is the process. Yeah, we have concerns about the constitutionality, but for the most part, there's no belief that the Chinese are stealing votes right now.
Yeah, no, I get all that. I get all that. And there's very, very various issues that people have out there. But it still comes down to the inability of people who are responsible for making sure these elections are fair and balanced, or that actually stand up to it. When people tell me, well, you're just going to have to accept that, okay? The court wouldn't listen to you. I said, well, the problem that I can't accept it is because the court didn't listen to it. The constitutionality of how Pennsylvania voted the last time is the whole key to all of this. Now, people believing that the machines were rigged, people believing that things took place, that's okay. You can have all those different ideas. But the whole thing revolves around the idea is centered on the fact that we had no excuse mail-in ballots. When you look at the hundreds, not thousands, hundreds of thousands of ballots that came in, and I'm not saying I had friends that were mad at me for contesting because they said, I couldn't get out and do it, and so you're challenging me. I said, I'm not challenging you and your right to vote or the way you vote, you know, how you voted, but I am challenging the fact that it was unconstitutional. And when we walk away from those basics, when we say all of a sudden that you're going to have to accept this because we say you're going to have to accept it, and I think for the general public and for the American people, say, why? Why in this election were we able to do this? And there's no way anybody can explain the number of ballots that were cast last time. It is just off the charts. And a lot of them came from areas that people said, well, that couldn't have happened. That couldn't have happened. So it's the inability of the courts to step up and do their part. This was a political decision made by all the courts saying, well, if we overturn an election, that's going to cause a massive uproar in the country. And I understand all that. But that's why we have processes in place. And when it comes down to the courts and the courts' inability to even hear a case, then people say there is no justice system. There is no justice system. Well, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, this was rigged. And other people come up and say, I don't know why you're pushing this because you're causing a lot of problems. I come back to what we've been talking about, Tyler. Whenever you're in a situation and you have a question, and the process that's supposed to be put in place does not work. That's why I said, no, there's no court, there's no law, there's no constitution that's going to keep people's belief in what actually comes out. The faith, the trust, and the confidence in our system is the key. That's the key. In other parts of the world, people vote and they have to put their thumb and ink, a purple ink, to prove that that they voted that day. We can't look at the numbers and say, well, wow, I guess it's not impossible to reach this thing, but it sure as heck makes me wonder what happened on that day. And the courts walking away from it, I think, is the thing that, again, that blows it. I see people every day that are still, they wonder about that election. It's not about Trump, by the way. People say, oh, you just like Trump, that's what we want. I said, no, I want to make sure that anybody understands the key. The first key is, please go get registered and then get informed, and then whatever the voting day is, get out and vote. If you can't vote, there's an absentee ballot that you can cast. I just think the no-excuse mail-in ballot causes people to wonder. So I think what you ought to do, and anything you do in your life, put in place policies that restore the confidence that people need to have. So, you know, we can bat this thing back and forth, and Trump people are going to say he got cheated out of election, and the Biden people are going to say, well, you're just mad because you lost. My answer to everything is, that day, everybody lost.
I know you have a hard out. Two questions. Have you made any endorsements in the Senate or governor race?
No, you know, that's this thing. I don't know that my endorsement would be that big anyways. But again, you get down to who is it that you're going to vote for and who is it that you'd endorse? We have a policy in the primary that we don't endorse. Now, that's the same policy when I first ran back in 2010. There were like 16 people running for the same office. And I would go to the people that were in office and say, can you endorse me? And they'd say, you get through the primary and we'll endorse you. I said, well, I can't get through the primary if I don't get endorsements. And so it was one of the how do you fix it? Our policy has been that we do not endorse in primaries. We did this time. We endorsed Sean Parnell. He's a very close friend of mine, and I thought just an excellent candidate. Unfortunately, he withdrew from the race. I've talked to a number of the people running for the Senate. I've talked to a number of people running for governor and said, you know what? You're a good candidate. Get through the primary, and we will work like heck to make sure that you win. I think that, again, the key to everything that we do is making sure that the people we represent get to know us. We have some people that are really... They're headline people, right? And people know them. And I think in elections, like everything else in life, it's people have a tendency to go to people that they like. They don't do a real deep dive on who they are. But I ask people all the time, please do your background, find out who it is that she or he is running, and then get out and vote. Get out and vote. In some elections, people say, I didn't like any of the candidates, so I didn't vote. And I said, well, you can do that because that's your right, but it's really important to be fully engaged. And this election, this primary is going to be interesting, both in the governor's race and the Senate race, especially the Senate race, because we have such high-profile people. When people ask me about it, I said, so I'm not endorsing anybody, my personal thing, because I've talked to these candidates. I've looked into their background. I am voting for Dr. Oz, but you vote for whoever you want for the Senate. When it comes to the governor position, I'm very close with a guy named Lou Barletta. We served in Congress together. I know Lou's background. I know Lou, and I know what his abilities are. So people ask me, are you endorsing Barletta? I said, nope, I'm voting for Lou. And if he gets through the primary, we're going to work like heck to make sure he gets there. On both sides of the aisle, though, Democrats and Republicans, these primaries are really, they're really tough. And I think that sometime the voters...
There's a lot of money, too.
Oh, God. Well, listen, you know what? It is. I think it's become too expensive. I don't know how many really good candidates never get a chance to run because of the cost of running. It is just amazing. When I first ran, and I talked to the guy who was running the Republican Party in Pennsylvania, he said, so how much of your own money are you going to put into it? I said, well, I've never done this before, so I don't know. And he says, well, you got to make a commitment. You know, I said, okay, well, my wife and I have talked about it. Well, I mean, I'm willing to put like $50,000. And he looked at me and said, $50,000? Are you kidding me? That doesn't get you even in the cheap seats. And I said, well, I, I don't know. I mean, I've never done it before. And I talk to a lot of people, and people that are really, really, you know, they're so patriotic, and they want to serve their country, and they want to serve their community. But the cost of getting there is just off the charts. And so I think we lose maybe people that would have been good at it, but it is. It's very expensive. We have high-profile candidates. I don't know of anybody that look at and say, this is a person you do not want to vote for. I just tell people that I run to, I said, please do your homework. And then in your mind, in your head, who is it that you want sitting in whatever seat it is, representing you, representing your values, representing who it is that you are, and representing America's basic principles? If you can make that decision, then that's fine. That's who you should do it. But endorsements, I think, are kind of, who cares?
Seems like a good place to end it. Thank you for giving us your time. I know we went
over our
allotment.
Listen, I love to do this with you. Yeah, hey, listen, we can do this anytime, but I really think that more than anything, I've never seen the country as aware as it is now. You made reference to the county commissioners and people going to these meetings, and I think it's great that the commissioners keep holding these meetings, but I also think it's important that the people understand it's up to you to determine who it is that represents you. Now, after the election, then it's up to all of us to come together and say, let's make sure that we're working for the right ends. And we can do that without being polarized. But that's where we need to get to. And we need to be, more than anything else, and we just celebrated Easter, which I think is the greatest of all the holidays that we have. This is talking about the action that he has risen, and we know what it is that we believe in. I just, I was so happy on Easter Day to find the church. When I go to St. Paul's, out of All Saints Parish, I said, oh my gosh, is it good to hear babies crying in church again? No, I'm serious. I mean, it was just one of those days that I thought, so we're back in church. We're back doing the things that we need to do. And it always, at the end of the day, we should be so thankful for the country that we live in and the process that we have. And it's up to us to make sure that it stays in place.
Well, enjoy the nice weather. Thanks again for stopping by.
Thanks, Aaron. Anytime. Thank you so much.
He's Congressman Mike Kelly. If you missed any of our interview, you can check it out at WISR680.com. And I'm Tyler Friel, and you have been listening to the Extended News at Noon.